to Reveal is back, and this time it's better than ever. We're giving away over 100,000 prizes, including three new Fiat 500 cars. Buy any slice and peel a tab for your chance to win. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, inviting you to taste the difference.
439-444-PIZZA-NOVA.
This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right. Welcome to Primetime Sports for a Monday. We have a Blue Jays roundtable. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch, and the At the Letters boys. I don't even mind if I call you that, do you? Ben Nicholson-Smith and Arden Zwelling joining us. The Blue Jays season in the bag. And I do mean bag. 67-95. We will get... Tomorrow, we'll get the official reaction from Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro during their media availability. But, guys, let's not waste any time. My first question would be, of course, I won't be there because I'll be on the air. My first question would be to Mark and Ross is, are you guys going to be back after next year? Because before I think we can have any discussion about free agents or anything, we need to know who's going to be running this team long term, don't we, Ben?
It certainly would help, right? Anytime you're looking at administration that has any sort of uncertainty, there can be a trickle-down effect. And so I think as the Blue Jays go into the offseason, you're trying to plan long-term. You're trying to potentially lure free agents who might be looking at, you know, 2-3-year deals. So I think it would definitely help, but I'm not sure that we necessarily get that resolution in the next little while.
As far as we know right now, they're both under contract for another year, correct?
That's what we know. Haven't seen the pieces of paper.
No, we.
It's what we believe.
Right. We're led to believe that they're both under contract. And to me, this is important. And we talked a bit about this on Blue Jay Central yesterday. To me, this is important because there are, as Scott Boras says, there are three things an agent wants to know when he talks to a team about his player. One, how much? Two, how long? And three, are you going to be there next year if we sign this contract? And yeah, I don't mean to be glib about it, but that's a significant question for any player coming here, or frankly, for any player looking to commit long term here.
It is. I wonder if it meant more back in the day than it does now. Like, players are so much trying to tailor where they're going to their desires and their experiences, right? So it helps to have some certainty in terms of the management of the team, but it also helps to, hey, what kind of shoe deal can I get in this market? You know, what kind of endorsements can I sign? So I wonder if players are starting, and we overuse the empowerment era term so much, but I wonder if they are starting to look at it a bit differently, and maybe it doesn't matter so much if, you know, the president is Mark Shapiro, Dave Dombrowski, or Alex Anthopoulos.
You know, it's interesting. Jeff brought up the first question he would ask those guys. My first question would be, I would ask them to self-evaluate their year, because I'd be curious to see how they answered that particular question. Because I think, you know, if you want to spin it positively, you certainly mention Bichette, Guerrero, and Gurriel, Danny Jansen, and the young guys who got a chance to play and took a step. Of course, there's another side to that. I don't think the pitching is necessarily in any kind of better position now than it was before. I think there are certainly issues when it comes to the outfield. And you have to be honest, I'd be curious to get your guys' take. I went back and looked at some of the projections for the Blue Jays this year, and they finished lower than those projections. Nobody expected them, obviously, to be a playoff team or anything like that, but most people thought they were a mid-70s kind of team, low mid-70s, and they're a 60-win team. So yeah. I wonder, I mean, if they're going to self... I don't know if they'll answer it, but I'd be curious how they would self-evaluate their year.
It's super interesting because there are so many things that go into it, and I think the win-loss is obviously a big variable. It has to be. Anytime we're talking about pro sports, right? You can't ignore that. It's also, to me, it reminds me of the fact that this time last year, Atkins said at this availability that the Blue Jays were probably through a lot of the worst of what this rebuild would look like. And so now, after 95 more losses, a season where, like you said, Richard, they probably fell short of expectations, at least in the win-loss column, you know, how much more losing are the Blue Jays expecting to endure? And if the answer is anything more than, you know, honestly, even a couple months, then there's reason for concern, because next year you could hope to at least be around 500.
What do you guys think? And again, there are reasons for this, but how much should they be judged on the attendance figures? If you're, you know, if you're Rogers management, if you're their bosses, understanding that the team, the product was going to be what it was going to be, it's still significantly down. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Mark Shapiro said something to the effect of, here's where I think we'll be, and the attendance was significantly less than where he thought they would be.
That's an interesting one, because, what, 30 teams across MLB are probably down, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, attendance is down across the league, and the Blue Jays did not field a entertaining or competitive product this year. And this market has shown
1.75 million. Right?
This market has shown, like, they'll come out if you're in the playoffs. They'll come out if you're going to contend. And if you're just okay, they're not going to come out to see Carlos Delgado. They're not going to come out to see Roy Halladay. They sure as hell are not going to come out to see the kids if you're not winning. And I wonder how important attendance even is to 30 MLB teams now in this era of massive television deals, of revenue coming from all kinds of different streams, of MLB Advanced Media putting, was it $50 million into the pocket of every team this year? I don't know. I don't know how much in-park attendance is really valued in 2019.
And let's remember, too, the payroll this year was not what it's been in the past. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're looking at how much money you lost, you probably did not bad, even with decreased attendance, because you didn't pay anything, and you raised ticket prices, too.
Can the I'm sorry, Jeff, can the in-game attendance in this city mean more because the package is not up for bid in the way in another market? They wouldn't have to, per se, be on the network that's owned by the team. You could sort of put it to an open bidding. So I wonder, in terms of revenue, the Blue Jays are always going to have less television revenue, right? Because it has to be on Sportsnet, where you could, in theory, make that up with, you know, 2.5 million people going to the park.
Right, and we saw that in the, you know, recent mini glory years of 15 and 16, just how people did show up. I think my sense was, internally this year, they knew that they were not going to have a lot of attendance, and the way they projected things, they were well aware of that. They went into the season probably understanding that, along with a 90 loss season, whatever they projected themselves at, that would go with a decline in attendance. So I don't think it's a shock. I think they, you know, if they start winning and it's still 1.75 million, then that's a big problem. But I think people will show up.
I don't even think, as a president or an owner, you look at total ticket sales. You look at your premium ticket sales. Because you can sell 100 discounted 500 level tickets for somebody who's going to buy a $2 hot dog, but that can be outvalued by selling 10 premium tickets to the lounge behind home plate, or Ben's smiling at me, but, you know, or to one of these areas.
Yes, the Ticketmaster Lounge.
Where you're also, you know, buying in for an open bar and buying in for all you can, and you know, you're buying sponsorships, and those revenues are more important than just filling up a section of the 500 level.
Let me ask you guys this. Would you extend Ross or Mark?
Yes, both. You have to.
It's very quick.
You're in the middle of a rebuild, and you have entrusted these two people to enact their plan, and the fans can, you know, agree with it or not, but you're in the middle of it, and the mistake that organizations and franchises make is changing in the middle of something. See the plan through. I don't think you give them a 5, 6, 7 year extension, but I don't see why you wouldn't give either of them a 2 or 3 year extension so they can see this thing through and see if it works out.
Because the scuttlebutt is out there that Mark has been looking at other jobs, right? We've heard about the SEC job. We've heard about the Big Ten commissioner's job. Again, none of this has been confirmed, but there are people, Major League Baseball executives and former general managers, who have called around, and the word seems to be out there that something may be afoot here.
It's always so interesting, right? Because the kind of level of power broking that can happen is far greater than anything that I'm used to. But yeah, Mark Shapiro is in that world of people who have a lot of influence. And when a big job comes up, there's a lot of gossip, just like there would be around the water cooler at any workplace when there's a big opening. So this is on a different scale, obviously. I expect that Mark Shapiro will be around. I think it's an interesting question, Blair, as far as, you know, should these guys be around? How long should they be here? As Arden said, though, it would it would create a lot of chaos in a way if you were to pull the plug right now.
Well, just look at, I mean, look at the high performance. Look at everything that has happened on their watch. That I'm not saying you would have to effectively undo everything, but some of it would have to be undone. And I mean, I'm kind of with you, guy. I don't know if anybody, unless somebody came in here with the philosophy of we are going to contend every year, come hell or high water. I don't know if any other general manager or president has this team any farther ahead than they are right now. I mean, I really don't.
As a fan, you want certainty. Like, you want stability at the top. You don't want, you know, comings and goings and this constant revolving door and there not to be a plan. You want there to be somewhere where these people believe that they are going. You want there to be a process. And you want there to be evidence, empirical data behind what they are doing. Like it or not, that's what these guys have given you. I'm not saying it's going to work in the end, but they've been very clear about what they're going to do, when they're going to do it, and where they see themselves getting to. We don't yet know the last one. Where are they going to end up? We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, everything you guys said makes sense. And I think there's an argument to continuity when it comes to front offices. And historically, in almost every sport, the front offices that stay long-term are usually the most successful. You know, less turnover usually means more success, including in the coaching ranks. I do wonder for both guys, and I know all three of you would be closer to this than me, but how do you evaluate them just in terms of talent evaluators? Because the only thing I would say is that while continuity is really important, someone has to make sort of a decision in terms of how good talent evaluators are Shapiro and Atkins versus whoever you consider in baseball to be the best talent base, whether you think it's Brian Cashman or somebody else. And I think that's a fair question to ask. And I wonder if at what point do the results have to be on the field or not on the field for that question to be answered?
Yeah, and so much of it is walking that line between evaluating the talent itself and then creating these structures that allow for your scouts to get into place. And it really starts to seem really corporate, and it really is. But Jeff Luhnow, I don't think, you know, is out there necessarily scouting the Astros' next big prospect, but he's right. The one setting the system in place so that when the Dodgers are asking which prospect you want, he says Jordan Alvarez. 2 years later, he's there hitting homers for the Astros. So I think part of it is the system and the structure that you set up. I know that's a really kind of bland and corporate sounding answer, but I think that's the way things work a lot of the time with baseball front office.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I don't know if Ross Atkins, how many players he sees in person before they draft them or before they trade for him. I have yet to get a clear answer as to what Mark Shapiro's role is in terms of actual hardcore baseball decisions. I mean, I don't know. It depends who you talk to. Look, we talk to the same guys. Either he's got his hand in everything or, well, you know, Ross, he's delegated stuff to Ross. The thing that concerns me is, and Arden, I'd like you to chime in on this. The thing that concerns me is somebody's got to figure out the pitching. Like somebody in this organization has to. They just need to do a better job identifying what is a major league pitcher, because they brought too many guys in who sucked. I can't put it any other way. They brought guys in who I guarantee would not get a look by any other team.
So I got two points. I'll talk pitching, but I want to loop back to that front office thing, because sometimes we still ascribe these MLB front offices as if there's one guru who's making all the decisions. And like it or not, the way the Blue Jays operate is very collaborative, and I know everybody hates that word. But they, you know, you talk to somebody in the Blue Jays front office about a decision that was made, they're just as likely to say, oh, well, Mike Mourav had a lot to do with that, or Andrew Tinnish, or Joe Sheehan. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just Ross Atkins, like, marching in and saying, we want player X. It has been a recommendation that has been filtered through scouts and analysts and this whole machine. Now, the byproduct of that is that it's hard to know who to blame when things go wrong, because the blame is spread out over a number of individuals. That is the way the Blue Jays operate. When it comes to pitching, they didn't have a good story this year. We did exit interviews on sportsnet.ca all week. We are running exit interviews with every single Blue Jays player. Ben Shai and I went around, asked all of them, what'd you think of your year? You know, what were your successes? What were your failures? I was just running through the starting pitchers today, which went up this morning. It's a depressing read. Like, it's guys saying disappointed, awful, I was terrible, it was rough. Like, to a T, every man is saying how they sucked, like you said, Blair. So you want to see that accountability from pitchers who underperformed. That's good. But it also means you didn't have a good story. Yeah. You didn't have a Jacob Wagstaff showing up and setting the world on fire, or TJ Zoik or Anthony Kay. Like, you didn't have a guy, even Trent Thornton, who probably had the best season of the bunch, had these great peaks and valleys and ended up with a 5 ERA at the end of it. So you didn't have that nice story in your starting pitching staff. The best starting pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays pitches for the New York Mets.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep. Very true.
Yeah, you know, I've said this to Blair before. I actually think the key figure in how long the current front office will continue is Nate Pearson. I don't think it's any of these offensive guys. I think it's Nate Pearson. And for their purposes, and this is pretty tricky, they're going to have to figure out what the timetable is for him in terms of bringing him up, because you're almost, in my opinion, essentially penciling him as a frontline start. He's basically a one or a two for you, has to be. And then if that is the case, you can then sort of figure out around it. If he turns out not to be, you're done, I think, as a front office. I don't, unless, I guess, with one caveat, you could then theoretically go into free agency and try to create your staff.
But he's not, you don't want him to be your number one or number two next year.
Not next year. I'm saying I would say 2 or 3 years down the line. I'm not sure he'd pitch in the majors next year.
Well,
he might, but I don't think that's a guarantee.
Pearson will pitch in the majors
next
year?
Probably will, but I think
he definitely will.
You think that's a guarantee?
I think absolute guarantee.
Yeah.
How many innings do you think he'll
absolute
got?
Guarantee. I don't know how many innings he will throw at the end. I think they will probably structure it in a way that he starts his year slowly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I bet you he is on a mound at Rogers Center in late May at the latest, maybe June.
Okay.
And I bet you he's going to be exceptional.
Yeah, I didn't I didn't feel that way originally. I thought that they would maybe, I was going to say drag it out a bit, but I just think they're going to get to the point where they can't run the same pitching out there. And even if Ryan Barucki comes back and is healthy, they can't run the same starting pitching out there. If Nate Pearson's one of your best arms in spring training, and I'm with Arden in this, I mean, read the stuff you guys have written on it. Again, anybody can get injured, but all the underlying stuff suggests that this kid should be really good when he gets up here. I think they almost have to get him up here as soon as they can.
I think that if he hadn't missed that entire year with the broken arm, he probably already is here. I think he would have had what he did this year. He would have done that in 2018. And I think he would have been so good this season that he would have come up. It would have been the same thing with Vlad and with Bo. It would have been, you can't just leave this guy toiling in the minors anymore. Screw your service time. Don't let him blow any more 104-mile-an-hour bullets down there.
Mm-hmm.
Bring him up.
So why not? Okay, let's presume you're right, and let's say he comes up next May. If that's an understanding, whatever he's going to pitch, 100, you know, however they sort of limit a guy.
It'll
like
be
that.
Limited for sure.
Right. So when do you then decide to time your hitters? Do you make the commitment for next year to get, again, I'm throwing this out there, whoever, you're not going to get a Garrett Cole, but like, let's say there are a couple of number three type of starters available. Do you try to build the staff immediately for next year, try to time it with Pearson? Maybe you can get to 80 wins or something like that. Or do you punt next year, hope the fan base doesn't kill you again for another low 70s year, all planning for 2021 when maybe Nate Pearson is a 180 inning pitcher, maybe a guy like Manoah is that, you know what I'm saying? Like what's the plan to try to time this?
That's the thing about starting pitching is I believe it has to be internal, or the majority of it has to be internal. I think you can augment your staff and you can go get a Greinke or you can go get a Verlander, but I think that the majority of your starting pitchers have to be young homegrown guys, or young guys that you traded for, like a Thomas Hatch or Jacob Wagstaff. Like, you need them to be that. Look at, that's why the Tampa Bay Rays are so good year after year, because they just have these phenomenal pitchers somersaulting out of their system with 95 mile an hour arms that they like signed out of Venezuela for $40,000, you know, and they just show up and they use them in all these different roles. It's all internal. So I think the Blue Jays, getting back to what I said before, need good stories on their pitching staff. They need Jensy Diaz to show up and be this like ground ball machine, or Sean Reed Foley to figure it out. They need something like that to happen.
What's your confidence level, though, that those stories exist beyond Nate Pearson?
Man, based on what we saw this year, it has to be low, because we didn't see one of those stories this year.
Yeah.
It's a Jays postmortem with Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, Jeff Blair, and Richard Deitch. Talk about the manager. We'll get to Vladdy, but let's talk about Charlie Montoyo. How would you evaluate Charlie's season, Ardency? Someone asked me this yesterday, and I said, and I'm not generally one to punt. I don't know how I evaluate his season, because how do you evaluate? To me, it's how you handle pitching if you're the manager. And I don't know how you evaluate what he was given this year.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you look at the staff, and you know, speaking of those exit interviews, we didn't even get to Edwin Jackson and Ryan Feuerbend and all the guys who've been cut off the roster, you know, the Zach Ross Cups of the world. That's honestly what Charlie Montoya was dealing with this year.
You made that name up.
Who? He's real. Zach Ross Cup.
He exists.
Check the stats. Zach Ross Cup pitched for the Toronto Blue Jays in 2019. This is real life. And that was the staff that he had to deal with. So, you know, to handle that staff, to handle the adversity as far as some injuries that were unexpected to guys like Vladdy and Gurriel, it was a lot. And I think for any rookie manager, there's a big learning curve. So I think that you say this was a year where he learned stuff. I think we saw him tactically behave differently. Not as many pinch running appearances for Vlad Jr. Not as many bunts later in the season. That's good. Mm-hmm. I think you like seeing that. And he kept the team afloat. And that's easier said than done when you have 95 losses, when you have a coach that left the staff midway through the year, when you have a pitcher who was really unhappy in Toronto and Marcus Stroman. I mean, he didn't want to be here. He really sabotaged the Blue Jays' leverage, and he ended up getting traded and throwing a temper tantrum. And I don't mean to say that. Like, look, Marcus Stroman is someone who had a really good career here. I'm not trying to undermine that, but he was really unhappy. And still throughout that, the Blue Jays kept things afloat.
To me, with Charlie, like, you got three buckets, right? What was strong, what was kind of in the middle, and what was weak. To me, what was strong is what you're talking about, fostering a culture of mm-hmm. trust and positivity, which is a hard thing to do on a, you know, 95 loss team, of learning, of trusting with the coaching staff. He trusted his coaches, trusted Matt Bushman and Pete Walker and Guillermo Martinez to work with players. He fostered a good culture. The development was good. Mixed in-game decision-making, because we saw a lot of bunting that I hated. We saw it change. We saw some pinch-running decisions I did not agree with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. We saw that changed. So that's mixed, I think. It was good and bad. Weak was the forward-facing part of the role and dealing with the management, or dealing with media, excuse me, and conveying thoughts and strategy and decisions. I don't think he got better at the forward-facing part of the role, which is a part of it in 2019 mm-hmm. in MLB. I think you have to be good at that because you are speaking not just to us in the media. You're speaking to fans. You're speaking through us. So I thought that part was weak.
How much input do you think the analytics people, in quotations, Ross Atkins, have on the day-to-day, you know, on the setting of the lineup? I'm not going to say the day-to-day managing of the team, but in the setting of the lineup, things like that. How much of that is Charlie? How much of that is a quote-unquote collaborative effort?
I feel like we've all been trying to figure out all year.
Yeah. Right? I'm hoping you guys have some insight, because
what percentage of the lineup decision is analytics? What percentage is high performance? What percentage is Charlie? You know, what percentage is the front office? Right? Like, we just don't know. It's some sort of collaborative thing. But on certain days, you'd ask, hey, why wasn't this guy in the lineup? It'd be, oh, that's HP. And then on other days, why isn't this guy in the lineup? Oh, that's analytics. And on other days, why isn't this guy in the lineup? Oh, I wanted him, but I couldn't. Like, you know, it was such the goalposts were moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would see Charlie throughout the year kind of keep track of, all right, Brandon Drury has played once in the last 3 days. I want to get him in there. Or Eric Sogard's only played once in the last, you know, four. I want to get him in there. So with that aspect, I think it was almost like pen and paper, just like right. back of the envelope type thing. But there's no doubt in my mind that Vlad Jr. would have played more if high performance didn't exist. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, by the way, because he came pretty close to having some, you know, some knee scares twice, once with his left knee, once with his right. And they seem to have gotten through the season, but I think he rested at times because of what the training staff said.
Yeah, I think in terms of determining a grade for him, I'm with Black. Like, I don't know how you do it. Like, he was essentially given an impossible task in terms of the win-loss of the year. 39 different starting pitchers or something to that effect, if you include, like, the...
Yeah, is Luke Maley in
Yeah,
there,
the guys like, who are not pitchers. Know, yeah. I mean, figure out whoever your best manager is in baseball. What is that person? I mean, maybe three more wins, two more wins. I think he got, in terms of win-loss, the most out of this roster. What's interesting to me and sort of... just hearing you guys discuss is, how do you evaluate the in-game stuff, which is a little sort of subjective depending on how we all think about it. I think the culture part is his biggest win. His players talk really well about him. It's a good group, but there were essentially, outside of Stroman, essentially really no issues or distractions. You know, the media part, like first year manager, I always feel like they're trying to find their way regardless of what sport they're in. And I felt, at least from watching a lot of the post game stuff, I felt, you know, Charlie seems to be a pretty affable guy, kept an enthusiastic bent during a very pretty down year. So I think he certainly deserves another year. And probably, unfortunately for him, is he's tied so much to what the front office brings him. I don't think that maybe unless things drastically change, like, do you see more than 5 to 10 more wins for this guy? I feel in a way bad for him because I think he's going to end up being the bridge to whoever they hire when this team gets to be good. Now, maybe you say to yourself, okay, listen, you got the opportunity. You were a career minor leaguer. You take the job regardless. But I don't think, I mean, I hope for his case he is, but I don't see him around 3 or 4 years from now when this team maybe legitimately is a contending team. We'll see.
If your question is, you know, how much can a manager impact wins and losses on the field? Like, I think everybody's been trying to figure that out for a long time. Right. And I don't know what it is, but I don't think it's high. You know, like, I think it's pretty low. You're affecting things on the margin.
I think, don't you think that opinion's changed, though? Because back in the day, people would say, like, Tony La Russa is worth 9 wins. Yeah. You know, I think it's BS, but there used to be that sort of thesis that a strategic manager can get you that many more wins.
And even, you know, Charlie's job was so much more about fostering the culture and continuing development for young players who are still developing. Like, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is 20. He's still developing. He's still learning. We all saw the learning experiences that he had this year, same thing with Bichette, Biggio, Wagisback, like basically every player under the age of 28 that was on this team, which was most of them. That was so much more a part of his job than just, you know, sign stealing and bunts and things like that.
Speaking of the young players, we will turn our focus to Vladdy, Bo, and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. It's Primetime Sports, the Blue Jays Roundtable on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends from an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has that too, and it's free.
It's free.
Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks. Whether you want to get in on the football action, tonight's baseball game, or anything in between, head over to Oddshark.net and start playing like a shark today. This is not a gambling site.
Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder that it's your final week to nominate your hockey team to play at Toronto's Cathedral of Hockey. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for your chance to win and play in the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, brought to you in part by The Beer Store. Submit nominations and find details at sportsnet.ca/590. This is a Blue Jays postmortem. Richard Deitch, Jeff Blair, Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith. We've covered the front office. We've covered the manager. Let's talk about the players, or in particular, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I have this theory that's not very popular, but I think, leave aside what Pete Alonso did this year, he's an older guy. But I think what we saw from Juan Soto and Ronald Acuña Jr. last year raised the bar for what constitutes a good rookie season. And based on that, I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s rookie season was just fair. It was less than I thought. I mean, I expected better numbers, expected better OPS. I expected a little more improvement defensively, but I'm, you know, how do you measure that? I want to ask you guys this because that was going to be the positive story for the Jays this year, wasn't it? The young guys. And I think, you know, if I'd said to you at the start of the year that Vladdy Jr. probably won't finish in the top three in National League Rookie of the Year voting, I think we'd all say, God, that's a disappointment.
Right. Yeah. Ben? And Kevin Biggio is probably the guy who deserves to finish higher than Vladdy in Rookie of the Year voting with the year that he had. Yeah. But yeah, I would agree. I think that what you said there is really fair. I mean, Vlad Jr. was someone who I'll speak for myself here. I expected him to be one of the best hitters in baseball right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's partly because of guys like Soto and Acuña. and he just didn't rise to that level. He was still an objectively above average hitter, and that's a tough thing to do at any age. It's especially tough to do at 20 years old. He was the youngest position player in baseball, but the expectations were higher. And so now, you know, it sets up a really interesting offseason for him. I think that there are a lot of ways this could play out from here. It's not a foregone conclusion that he is going to be this living legend. I think that potential absolutely exists where he could be a franchise player, but he needs to work to get there.
So I know Ben's read The MVP Machine. I don't know about you guys.
I have not read it, no.
It gets into how the aging curve for hitters has moved. Mm-hmm. And it's now a lot earlier, and it's fair to expect a 21-year-old to be very good. The prime for a hitter may no longer be 27 to 32. I don't know where it is, but it may be like 24 to 28. So it's fair to expect Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to be pretty darn good already. And I think the tools are absolutely there. I think we saw him meet adversity for the first time in his baseball playing life this season. For the first time, he had negative feedback to what was working for him and what he was doing. You saw him go through a physical grind because he was not well-conditioned enough for a 162-game mm-hmm. season. You saw him go through a mental grind and learning how to overcome failure, learning how to deal with umpires that weren't giving him calls, and learning how to deal with pitchers who are attacking him very carefully and very selectively, having to learn how to be patient, how to stick to your approach when you aren't getting the results that you want to, going through a period where he had very good exit velocities, but for one reason or another, he was hitting the ball into the ground.
Right.
These are all things that you need to overcome as a big league ballplayer, and I just think that you saw Vladimir Guerrero Jr. struggle with them this year, but you can be encouraged that he can learn how to deal with those and that the raw tools and the raw ability is very much there for him to be a superstar.
Yeah, and I think and we have to keep this in mind, too. Unlike Ronald Acuna Jr. and Juan Soto, he was plopped down in the middle of a pretty dire lineup. Both of those guys had pretty good hitters around him. Vladdy Jr. did not have much in the way of support offensively.
Yeah, it's interesting to listen to you guys analyze him because I think you make a lot of points. The only thing I would add to this is this. I think when you're measuring him, it's hard to measure him objectively on his numbers without thinking of the expectations leading in.
But Juan Soto and Ronald Acuna Jr., they had the same expectations.
Absolutely.
They were top prospects.
All I'm saying is that I think what we think of his year has so much to do with the expectations that I'm using the collective we, that we put on him. So I think his year was certainly below what our expectations were. What I'm trying to say is, you know, look at his year sort of, if you can, in an individual prism. And I think it will be, I come off that it was a good, not great first year. What will be interesting, and I think you both hit on this, is will he be conditioned next year to be a 162-game player? How much was facing pitching this year going to speeding up his development? And then lastly, something obviously Blair and I have talked about forever, is defensively, what ultimately is he? And at a certain point, would any issues defensively hinder his progression offensively? And then what do you do to rectify that? But because he's so young, and I know what you're saying about, you know, sort of hitters, the curve is different, but we're still talking about such a young guy. He could be a totally different player, hitter, you know, literally 24 months from now.
Well, we're going to find something out of this offseason and next spring about his level of motivation.
Agreed.
To be the absolute
Definitely.
Best mm-hmm. that he can be. Because we've seen now, like, he's still, we talked about his season like it was some colossal failure. He was an above average major league hitter at 20. He's the youngest player in the league. So his baseline could be maybe right below that of an all-star, mm-hmm. maybe even an all-star. But his ceiling is so, so much higher if he works hard and if he conditions himself well, if he mentally commits to this. But you're dealing with a kid who at 16 years old, you gave him $4 million. And his family is already royalty in the Dominican Republic. So do you really want to be great? Like, do you really yeah. want to be a Hall of Famer and the best player on the field every single day?
You know, and
that's going to have to be the motivation for him.
You know, the interesting thing with him is, too, and this is just a reality, is prodigies, like people who we expect this stuff from, someone, let's say, like LeBron James or Kevin Garnett or, you know, pick your football player. A lot of times their bodies allow them to do anything. They are essentially, for their sport, five-tool guys. Vladdy is not. Vladdy in order to get the most, I think, out of his body is going to have to work at his body. You know, it's all do. You know, he's just not naturally one of these guys who's created like marble, like a Greek god. So in terms of motivation, it's going to be really interesting because we will, I think, learn a little bit about how great he wants to be. Because he will be good, seriously, yeah. just based on his sort of innate talent. Yeah. But I think in order to be great or a top 10 player, let's say, in the league, we'll learn it. He's going to have to invest in physio, nutrition, fitness, all that stuff, I think, to be great. But he has the hardest thing, which can't be taught, right? Which is basically this innate hitting ability. That's I think, God-gifted, basically.
Yeah, exactly. That's an incredible advantage that he has to be the kind of hitter that he is and to have grown up in that kind of environment. He also has some examples around him of guys who have taken that next step and gone from good professional players to really good. And I think Rafael Devers is one example
yep.
Within the division, someone that Vladdy knows and chats to every time the Red Sox play the Blue Jays. He and Devers are exchanging banter, and I think that's one of those examples. He got into better shape, got to be a much better defender at third base, and boom, he's probably one of the 10 or 15 best players in the American League this year. And at the same time, you can even look within the Blue Jays clubhouse. Kevin Biggio really pushed himself to another level, and I think Bo Bichette has too. Compared to where they were drafted. So those are examples the Blue Jays need Vladdy to follow.
Can this team realistically expect 2 years down the road to have an infield of Vladdy at third, Bo at short, Biggio at second, Tellez at first?
I would swap in Groshans at third and put Vladdy at first in 2 years.
Okay.
That's where I'm at.
Yep. Yeah, I'm with you on that for what it's worth.
I'm there three quarters of the way. You know, I'm not sold that Rowdy Tellez is an everyday player. I mean, mm-hmm. He hit 21 homers, but his OPS plus is right around league average. So I like the first three. Tellez still has to show me something.
Yeah. And have we pretty much eliminated any concern about Bo being able to play shortstop?
I think right now at this point in his career, there's no reason why he can't play short every day.
Because that was
year.
Something people were wondering about, right? Would he need a position move?
And it speaks to his motivation
yes.
and his work ethic and his development. He's come a long, long way. Coming out of the draft, people are saying, yeah, he's going to be a second baseman someday. Mm-hmm. And now it's, yeah, he's a major league shortstop. He's capable. He's not Angelton Simmons. You know,
right.
He's not going to probably not going to win a gold glove, but he's making all the plays.
We've just got 3 minutes left here before we scoot. Give me your two-item wish list for the Blue Jays.
Only two?
Oh, yeah. Give me your wish list for the Blue Jays.
Man, they need a lot more
okay,
than two.
Give me your wish list for the Blue Jays.
I mean, I want to trade for a really good starting pitcher. I don't mm-hmm. think you're going to get a really good starting pitcher in free agency. You could try to get Gerrit Cole. I just don't think he's coming to Toronto. I want to trade for a really good starting pitcher. I want a center fielder. I want really positive stories from young pitchers in my system. I want Jency Diaz to take a big step forward, or Sean Reed Foley to be a lot better, or Thomas Hatch to come out of nowhere, or just one of these 20 names that we mm-hmm. hear so much about. Somebody needs to be a positive. Somebody needs to be what Ben's talking about with Kevin Biggio, where they go from org guy to, hey, this can be an everyday player yeah. on a big league team.
Yeah, starting pitcher, center fielder, starting pitcher, you know, basically along those lines.
Are we okay with the order, with the middle of the order as it is? Again, I know you have to prioritize things. You can't get everything. Or would you like to see maybe a more veteran thumper in the middle there?
I think they need a bat, and I think there's room for someone who's versatile, you know, someone who could play a bit of first base. Maybe it's a little bit of second base. Maybe it's corner outfield because, you know, Randall Grichuk finished strong, but you don't necessarily have to play him 7 days a week. It can be five. Or Lourdes Gurriel Jr. has missed time. Maybe you need someone who's going to play a little bit of left field. So mm-hmm. I think you mix that in. This team doesn't have nearly enough offense either.
The playoffs start tomorrow on Sportsnet, the National League Wild Card, Brewers and Nationals. Coverage begins at 7 o'clock. First pitch is, I believe, just after 8. Wednesday, the American League Wild Card, the Rays and the A's from Oakland. Coverage begins at 7:30 on Sportsnet, 590 The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. Gentlemen, thanks so much for doing this. Thanks so much for your availability and your help all season long.
Cheers.
Anytime.
We'll do it again. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about. Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro have their media availabilities tomorrow. We will, of course, keep you covered. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Sportsnet.ca will be your destination for all the breakdown of what Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro have to say tomorrow. We'll take a break and we come back. Jeff Merrick, host of Hockey Central, the NHL and Sportsnet, and 31 Thoughts will join us. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. When searching for a home for Toronto's best sports talk, this is the prime location. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch. Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, it is Primetime Sports for Monday, November 30th. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch will be joined by Justin Cripps, Olympic gold medalist, bobsled driver at 5:35. The story by now, Kaylee Humphries has been released from her contract by bobsled Canada Skeleton, and she will be competing for the United States, or she'll be eligible to compete for the United States, at least, and will be taking part this week in U.S. team trials. And we'll talk to Justin Cripps. He is sort of assumed the role of team spokesperson in this whole situation. He'll join us at 5:35. Eric Smith joins us from Quebec City. He's our Raptors radio voice on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The Raptors have begun training camp in Quebec City. 6:30, Amy Trask, NFL analyst, CBS Sports. And in a few minutes, Jeff Merrick, host of Hockey Central, NHL, and Sportsnet in 31 Thoughts. And ice surfing will join us, providing he can finish his work in the NHL preview. A reminder, we have Leafs home opener tickets, and they could be yours. Tune in all day today and tomorrow for your chance to qualify for a grand prize draw. On Wednesday morning, the leadoff, our morning show with Ashley Docking, Mike Zigamanis, and Scott MacArthur, will announce a qualifier's name. And if it's you, call back within 590 seconds to win the tickets. You can call us now and be the fifth caller through to qualify at 416-870-0590, star 590 in your cell, 1-888-666-0590. Stay tuned all day Tuesday for more chances to qualify. And as always, for more info, visit sportsnet.ca/590. So, Richard, an enlightening hour with the At the Letters boys. And again, a reminder, At the Letters podcast, they do not take the off-season off. So you can find it on sportsnet.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. And they will keep you informed as to the comings and goings, issues surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays. I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, that at some point, Richard, and I don't pretend to know when exactly it was, but we've gone from thinking that this team could be better next year to hoping the team will be better next year, but almost subconsciously gearing ourselves up for the fact that it may be another year of 67 to 70, 72 wins. I mean, this is the thing, whatever. How many wins do they get? They're 67. If they improve by 10 games, they're still going to be under 500.
Yeah, think about that. They improve by 10 games, they're 77 wins.
Yeah,
I mean, that's still gonna be under 500. A down year.
Yeah.
I do think the timeline, Jeff, has changed a little bit. I think it's been pushed back.
Agreed.
And I think the expectations that of whatever next year was going to be. And I think, at least if I remember from the beginning of the year in conversation, people were like, all right, maybe they're a 500 team next year, you know, like kind of an 81-81. Mm-hmm. Nobody who covers the team, nobody who's informed right now, have I heard that from. Maybe they will surprise, but given where the pitching stands now, I cannot see them breaking the 70-win barrier unless something really, really crazy happens. So the larger question, Jeff, is with another developmental year, what would you as a fan want to see where you can deal with what will be a subpar under 500 record, but it really makes you believe that the 2021 season, like, you're a real contender?
You've got to see some pitching.
I think that's the only thing.
You have to see some pitching. I'll tell you this. If Vladdy Jr. doesn't have a measurably better year,
that'll be concerning.
That will be concerning.
I agree with that.
And I think he will.
So do I.
But that will be concerning if that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
because that'll be and Arden was right. He is young, but everybody's young. And good players play in their age 20 years, 20 seasons, and have really good years.
Well, great players do, right?
Great players do. Right. They have great years their first 20 in the first full season league. That's just the way the game has gone.
Yeah, you are correct on the pitching. One thing we did not talk about with these guys, which would have been interesting, and I'll ask you this. They have the fifth pick in the upcoming draft, which is a very, very...
No clue what they're going to do.
Well, very, very high pick.
Highest pick they will have had since Vernon Wells.
Okay. Realistically, if you take the best available arm at that pick, are you still looking at minimum 3 years away from that?
I would be lying if I said I've paid any attention.
Okay. All right. Because again,
I have no clue. I do know that it's...
Theoretically, that should be a high-end starting pitcher, given that you have the fifth pick in the draft.
Yeah. But...
I get it. It's still a lottery. It's a crapshoot.
Yeah, high school pitcher, college pitcher.
But you know, you have the opportunity to get what will essentially be one of the best pitching prospects out there, and so that should give you at least another real lottery. Not lottery ticket's too strong. That should give you another asset wherever you're trying to time it for. You know, you'll have another potential starter. Manoah, from everything I read, looked pretty good. We'll see.
It's hard to tell. He's an older guy, and it's Vancouver.
Yeah.
I mean,
I understand.
I want to see him pitch in the Florida State League or in Double A against.
Yeah, you will next year.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But
it's a philosophical and organizational question: is whether you draft a college pitcher versus a high school pitcher anyway, right?
I mean, you just take the best. You trust your scouts. You take the guy that your scouts like the best. The one thing that drives me nuts about baseball. And about the baseball draft is I really do believe you can overthink these things. Take the best guy available.
Well, they're not, but
and
they're,
make it and no. But the thing is,
they're not going to take a middle infielder though, or a third baseman.
Absolutely, they would.
I'd be very surprised
because everybody in baseball does that now. They draft the middle infielder and move position. That's why you do it. Take a look at most of the, I shouldn't say most, a lot of the center fielders who are high prospects right now, they're all drafted as infielders. Like the Jays at some point are going to have to take some of their surplus infielders and move them in the outfield. That's how the Cubs built their team. The Cubs have five drafted shortstops.
Right. I know Chris Bryant was.
Around, and they move them around the diamond. So if the best position player is a high school middle infielder, take them and move them.
I think they're going to draft an arm,
but I'm sure they'll draft an arm. But I'm just saying that if I could get another hitter, because there's not much left in terms of position players in this organization. There's nobody who's going to come up next year and wow you as a position player. Maybe in 2 years, Jordan Groshans is the guy. There's nobody else that's going to come up. And here's the thing: if it takes you 3 years to get all your developmental guys up there, well, you're in Vlady Guerrero's fourth year, and you may be looking at a guy who's going to be going into free agency the year after the next year. So, you almost get to the point where in the draft you start looking post-Vladdy and start looking at where the next crop of young kids are coming from.
Well, to me, if Shapiro and Atkins can... we'll get extended, and we'll eventually learn that.
Or we may not.
Yeah. Everything sets up though for 2021. To me, that's when you'll have Pearson in his theoretical second year. You hope to have somebody like Baruchy, hopefully establish themselves somewhere in the rotation, and then I think I don't know what the class is right now, but you hope to get a semi decent pitcher from, let's say, that free agent class. Leading into 2021, and then maybe, you get lucky and one of these Anthony K types or somebody else can be like a fourth starter, and then I think you have a chance to contend against the Yankees and the Red Sox. But there's a lot of things that have to happen.
First thing you have to do is contend against the Rays.
Yeah, and the Rays. I should add that too. Yeah, I mean they got a big. Jeff, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know. They can do everything right developmentally. And it still may not be enough because of the other teams.
I think that's absolutely right. And you take a look at the last time this team made the playoffs, it wasn't because of player development.
Yes, it was because of
trades,
yeah,
and free agent signings,
right,
and you know, hitting the lottery with Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah,
and it wasn't this. There was one homegrown player for the most part who was a regular in those lineups, and that was Kevin Pillar, who was like a 68th pick.
Yep.
So you can't sit there and say that the 2015-2016 Blue Jays were this carefully cobbled together, organizational group. They weren't.
You know, it's really interesting in the last couple of years, Jeff, the development of the Rays really changes the equation for this franchise, because you're not just chasing these two behemoths with endless amounts of money in Boston and New York. There's now another team that's really consistently going to be a playoff team.
And the other thing it does too is, you know, it removes this whole, yeah, but they, you know, they had to finish last. They had to tank to get those draft picks. Now, the Rays have had one of the best winning percentages in the major leagues in the past 5 years, and they've still managed to draft players, and they've still managed to develop pitching. So this is the thing that I think drives so many people nuts about the Rays, and why I love them so much, is they haven't tanked. They haven't been tanking for years, and they keep finding these guys.
They've also they have proven to be a great front office when it comes to trade evaluation.
Oh, that Chris Archer trade is incredible. And I remember at the time, everybody thought, wow, they're giving up an ace in Chris Archer. There's a kid, Shane Baz, who hasn't even like sniffed the majors yet, or he's been up a little bit. I mean, that's going to turn out, I really think that's going to turn out to be one of the shrewdest trades in like the last 10 years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's, you know, I hate to say this, but you compare and contrast that deal to the Marcus Stroman deal. Again, different situations. Chris Archer was already signed. You know, you were the Pittsburgh Pirates. You're getting a lot of contractual certainty with him. And I really think in hindsight, and this is not to blame this front office, because at no point was I suggesting they sign Marcus Stroman long-term for this reason. But if Marcus Stroman is signed to the type of contract Chris Archer is signed to, he is easier to move. That's another thing the Rays do. The Rays are very smart at positioning their commodities in a way that makes them attractive to other teams.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the key to the Stroman deal isn't going to be Anthony Kay. It's going to be, why am I blanking on that?
Simeon Woods Richardson.
And we'll see. Well, you know, I mean, again, it's all reading Baseball America, and that guy should be in the top 100 soon. But, like, you don't know. I mean, he's 18 or 19 years old. But, yeah, the Rays have proven time and time again they are great. They think outside the box. They make great acquisitions. Their minor league system is great. And I think if you're a Jays fan, it has now become so much tougher, because it's no longer Boston and New York anymore. I mean, the Rays should be good for a considerable amount of time. And you're then getting into the issue, Jeff, of just how many playoff spots are even available.
Right. Well, and you look, the Chicago White Sox are going to be better.
They will.
I think the Chicago White Sox, based on what we've seen from them this year, if the Chicago White Sox are positioned with a big offseason to take a huge jump forward.
And I think the Twins should be good for a while,
don't
you?
Nelson Cruz is getting on, but they've got young guys. They'll be okay. Cleveland, I think, is on the downward.
I agree. And Lindor's coming up in free agency.
But they're, when I say Cleveland's on the downward, I'm not going to say downward spiral, but when I say that they're going downward, they're still more than capable of being a factor in the wild card race. And I mean, the AL West is just a mess.
Yeah. Although I would say, again, I think the A's have proven to be a very smart organization.
Right.
And one of these days, I think the Angels are going to figure it out.
Well, I'll tell you what. Now, we know that Brad Ausmus was fired today. Joe Maddon, from all accounts, is already in there as manager of the Angels, or at least if he wants the job, it's his. And I got to say this, if they get Gerrit Cole in the offseason, and they will be the prohibitive favorite for Gerrit Cole in the offseason, there's another team that's positioned to improve.
And one thing to keep in mind there, you have to sort of follow the story, but Ohtani should pitch next year, right? His arm, in theory, would be healed. And, you know, if nothing else, Jeff, that's a middle of the rotation type, if not stuff higher than that. I mean, it's just adding another big time arm. I would watch out for them. I think they could be a playoff team next year if things break right.
Yeah, although I mean, I've given up in the Angels, frankly. The Angels do always have an amazing ability to shoot themselves in the foot.
Agreed.
That's entirely possible. But you're right. They should be. They should be and are positioned to be.
They have money.
A wild card team.
You know, they have money. So they can.
They have money. They have an engaged owner. They have, they have one person owning the team who wants to win. So, yeah, I what we're saying is you can reasonably expect next year that Chicago will be better. L.A. will be better. It gets crowded quickly. Even if
I think Boston has to be better, don't you think?
Just for argument's sake, Boston has a I don't know. I think Boston is on the verge of being a real mess. Let's see who they bring in. But what we're saying is I don't think the way ahead is getting easier for the Blue Jays.
Yep.
It's getting more and more complicated. The Toronto Maple Leafs set their roster today. And I don't know if there's any real surprise. I guess the fourth line players might have caught somebody off guard.
Timothy Liljegren surprised me. Did he surprise you?
He surprised me until I'm reading Chris Johnson's article on sportsnet.ca. And basically, that was a financial decision.
Okay.
With both, Toronto is going to be in the long-term injury provision for all 186 days of the regular season. Which, as Chris Johnson says, means it will be allowed to exceed the contractual ceiling once the contracts of Nathan Horton, David Clarkson, Zach Hyman, and Travis Dermott are shifted over to LTI. But eventually, the Leafs are going to have to carry a 20 or 21-man roster, and the cuts made Monday are just a starting point for this group. In other words, Timothy Liljegren, who did not have an overwhelming camp, unofficially beat out Ben Harper, Jordan Schmaltz, and Kevin Gravel. But as CJ points out, it's probably only a temporary solution. He has a contract that includes performance bonuses and carries a cap hit of $1.263 million. And this is with the team, the Leafs, that are less than $1,100,000 from the cap ceiling. So this would appear to be almost just the NHL's version of a paper move. But this is how, according to CJ, the Leafs break down entering the season. The first line is Johnson, Matthews, Nylander, Kapanen, Tavares, Marner, Mikheyev, Kerfoot, Moore, Timoshoff, Gauthier / Spezza / Shore, Riley, Ceci, Muzzin, Barry, Sandin, Marinson, Hall, Liljegren. The goaltenders are Frederik Andersen and Michael Hutchinson.
Hmm.
So I don't know if there's any real surprises there. Nick Shore might be a bit of a surprise, but that is the way the Leafs are expected to start going into opening night, which is Wednesday, against the Ottawa Senators.
What would be interesting, Jeff, if we certainly asked Marek this too, but like if you compared what you just read to the exact same thing at the start of last year, you would realize how significantly better this team is, particularly in the third, in my opinion, the third and fourth lines, and obviously on the blue line.
Well, we didn't know what Andreas Janssen was last year.
Right. But, I mean, you know, no.
I don't know about the forwards. On the blue line, certainly, they're much better with Tyson Barrie and Rasmus Sandin's youth, given that you know what Travis Dermott is, or you have an idea what Travis Dermott is.
And Hainsey Zaitsev last year, look how much ice time they lost.
Yeah.
So and, I think they're better for sure.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that this
And Patrick
is,
Marleau,
that this is
all due respect,
best defense core they've had in some time.
All due respect, logged a lot of ice time for a guy who was not, at least at the beginning, he was not producing. So
yeah.
I think they're a significantly better group. I will say, I am interested to see how many games early on, Freddie Andersen plays. I know Brian Burke was sort of talking to us about how you might think about splitting that. And, you know, can you get 25, 30 solid games out of this backup? We'll see.
Yeah, that is going to be, I think, one of the early season stories. Look, the Leafs are going to go to the playoffs. I'm one of those people that thinks, I mean, I'll pick them to win the conference just because.
Oh, you're stealing my thunder.
The Tampa Bay Lightning, I think, are still... if you put me up against a wall, I would probably go with Tampa Bay. But I don't see any reason that the Leafs can't. I'm with you. I think they're a better team than last year. But I don't know if any team carries a caveat the Leafs do about their goaltending. If Freddie Andersen is hurt, then all bets are off. Because this is a division loaded with goaltending. I mean, it really is. And it's the one position. I understand a lot of teams don't have don't have great depth at goaltending. I get all that. But the drop-off for the Leafs in terms of what happens if their goaltender gets hurt, to me, is greater than any other team in this, in this division.
Yeah. Lightning actually did pretty good when Vasilevsky went down last year, but maybe they were just such a good team that they could outscore people. But I agree with you. I think Freddie Anderson is the most important player on the Leafs.
Agreed.
He's certainly not going to be the highest paid and not the biggest star, but if he doesn't have a good year, or certainly if he has any kind of injury concerns, they're in significant trouble. Again, I would, and we'll see sort of how Babcock and Kyle Dubas play it. I think they're in a much better position if they can keep him as much under 60 as possible. I mean, if there's one thing that we have seen over the last couple of years, Jeff, is that, you know, Freddie can get tired late in the year. So you got to try to keep him fresh as you're heading towards the playoffs. Because ultimately, like you said, barring something crazy, they're going to make the playoffs. And ultimately, the season begins on that first, you know, that first game in that first round.
I'm with you. Now, where it gets interesting, of course, is how do you play Freddie down the stretch if you're playing to avoid a matchup you don't want?
Right. Although the matchup's going to suck regardless, right?
The other way to look at it is play the hell out of Freddie early, win as many games as you can, put yourself in the position where you're in the driver's seat. I think if I'm the Leafs, the first thing I'm doing is I'm basing a lot of Freddie Anderson's workload when I play Boston, when I play Tampa. I've got to beat those teams as often as I can in the regular season to give myself a leg up. I have to play Freddie as often as I can against those teams. I may not need to play Freddie on that Tuesday night game against Carolina. Maybe somebody else. Maybe that's when Michael Hutchison gets it. But I think we know enough about the Leafs and we know enough about what this division's going to look like that has to factor into the thinking.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to put your best foot forward against those teams. And if you want to rest the guy, and understanding that there are circumstances where you're going to have back-to-back games and you're probably going to have to rest him and your hand is going to be forced, you have to always err on the side of making sure that Freddie Anderson is in the lineup against Tampa Bay and against Boston.
The other thing I would say, too, is where they should be in a better position, at least in my opinion, is I think their penalty kill unit will be better. Certainly could not be worse than it was last year. So I think that's going to put them in a better position. And then again, as we mentioned,
I don't know. What do you base that on?
Well, I think you're going to see more Marner on the penalty kill. And if you look at their, I don't have it in front of me, but if you look at the where they ranked league-wide, it was pretty low, bottom third.
Yeah, but it's basically, I think it's the same.
They have better defensemen now to put for the year on both the PK and the power play. You have Muzzin for the whole year. You have Tyson Barrie for the whole year. I can't see Cody Ceci being any worse than a Hainsey or Zaitsev last year. I think
they will have more options on the power play because of the defenseman, and maybe there's a trickle-down effect.
Well, Spezza too, right?
Maybe that allows somebody else to occupy more ice time or get more ice time in the penalty kill. But I don't know about special teams. It's a different coach.
And a new special teams coach.
It's a different coach.
I'll look it up. It can't be worse. We've only seen them
in the preseason. Well, I don't know. I never say it can't be worse.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I
never see it can't be worse. Unless it's the absolute worst. Unless it was at the bottom of the league.
They weren't at the bottom.
It's entirely possible that it can get worse. But it would. I will say this. It would be a surprise if the Leafs, any part of their special teams.
Do you agree that their power play will be better this year?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. Should be. I
better Nylander, right? I mean, you'd think Matthews and Marner are better players.
They'll have more options, but I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell special teams based on what you see in the preseason. I think Merrick's probably still doing his preseason taping. So we will step away, and when we come back, Justin Cripps will join us. Kaylee Humphries has been given her freedom to compete for the United States. She is, of course, a former Canadian Athlete of the Year, winner of the Lou Marsh Award. She will compete for the United States. Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton made the decision, I think it was Saturday night, if I'm not mistaken, or that's at least when the news broke. Justin Cripps is an Olympic gold medalist, Canadian bobsled driver. He has emerged as a team captain, as a spokesman for the program. Justin Cripps will join us. It's Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder that it's your final week to nominate your hockey team to play at the Mattamy Athletic Center, formerly, of course, Maple Leaf Gardens. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for your chance to win and play in the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, brought to you in part by the Beer Store and Sportsnet 590 Fan. Submit nominations and find details at sportsnet.ca/590. This is a chance for your team to play at Mattamy Athletic Center. The game will be called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph. They'll be piped into the arena where you're playing. There'll be an after party, all sorts of good things. So again, go to sportsnet.ca/590 for full details on this contest. And no, it is not limited to teams in Toronto. So again, take a shot at it. You've got another week to do it, another week to set yourself up for that opportunity. The Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton issued a press release on Saturday, freeing, or I guess, let's put it this way, granting Kaylee Humphreys' request for a release from the Canadian program. Kaylee Humphreys, of course, a multiple Olympic gold medalist, multiple world champion, winner of the Lou Marsh Trophy as Canadian Athlete of the Year. One of the most decorated athletes, men or women, in the history of our country, filed a grievance against Bobsleigh Canada on January 19th, 2019. She filed a harassment complaint. On August 3rd, 2019, this August, Bobsleigh Canada received a request from USA Bobsled and Skeleton to release Kaylee so that she could compete for the United States. Kaylee Humphreys marrying an American as this process went on August 4th. She formally requested release from Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton, tying the request to the allegations of harassment. Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton investigated. On September 13th, she filed a lawsuit, she being Kaylee Humphreys, against Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton, seeking a mandatory injunction to obtain a release. 4 days later, October 17th, the Calgary judge denied Kaylee Humphreys' application for an immediate release from Bobsleigh Canada. And that was where it stood until 2 weeks later, until Saturday, until this weekend, when Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton issued a press release saying, as we mentioned, that while seeking input from all of the organization's key stakeholders, or after seeking input from all of the organization's key stakeholders, the board of directors of Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton had decided to grant Kaylee's request for a release from the program. She was taking part or was working out with the U.S. team in Lake Placid. She will now challenge for a spot in the U.S. team. And it's a, well, it's, I think the word, it's almost, it's an unsatisfactory end to kind of a strange set of circumstances. We never really received much details in the way of harassment. The thing, Richard Deitz, that was really surprising is how, I shouldn't say surprising, but the thing that was noticeable was how the remaining members of the team rallied around the program.
Yeah, I think what's clear is that, you know, the current coach clearly has the support of the current bobsledders there. But you're right, Jeff. It leaves a bitter taste in the mouth. You have a athlete who had a real legitimate chance for a medal in Canada. That athlete will no longer compete for Canada. That athlete will now compete for the United States, perhaps likely medal. And it remains unclear as to the veracity of this complaint and where does the truth lie? Who does it lie with? And I guess if nothing else, it seemed, and, you know, we'll ask our guests this, but it seemed like everybody just sort of at a certain point wanted to wash their hands of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's what the resolution has become.
Yeah, at some point, you know, the question becomes, do you want a team member who doesn't want to be on your team?
Clearly the answer is no, right?
Justin Cripps is a 2018 Olympic bobsleigh champion. He has been acting as a spokesperson for the bobsleigh Canada athletes. We're very pleased to be joined by Justin Cripps. Justin, thanks so much for joining Richard Deitch and myself on Primetime. I saw your comments to CBC after this announcement was made. On a personal level, how disappointed are you that this is how it worked out?
I guess I'm more disappointed just in the way it played out, you know, being such a kind of media storm and, you know, a lot of negative comments from both sides, well, from the public on both sides. The results, you know, I guess it is what it is. And, you know, I'm looking forward to just moving forward. We had a pretty good year last year and, you know, Kaylee took that year off and, we had a great team environment. So she had fight for the States now. And I think, you know, a lot of Canadians are disappointed with that. And, you know, I don't really think personally that the environment that we train and race in is, unsupportive or unsafe at all. So it's, I'm not sure if she always wanted to slide for the States or what. I don't really know. I can't speak for her, but it was an interesting thing to be a part of, that's for sure.
I was going to say, I mean, I've spent a little bit of time around the program going back to preparations for the Vancouver Games. And I think people need to know, I mean, you compete, you train, you travel. In some cases, you socialize with not just your teammates, but in some cases with opponents. You're like, this is a fairly closed community, isn't it? And you know, Justin, I just kept thinking to myself, I don't know what would be worse, having someone on another team that was once my teammate or having someone on my team that sort of didn't want to be there.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a family, really. Some of my closest friends are people on the Canadian bobsleigh team and on other nations' bobsleigh teams. Like you say, it's a super close-knit group. It's kind of a crazy and dangerous sport, and most of the athletes kind of band together over that and support each other. And I mean, it's pretty tough if you have somebody who, you know, doesn't want to be a part of that family and, you know, makes the atmosphere and the culture less enjoyable. It is certainly difficult. And there's been, you know, a number of people like that in the past. But, you know, the athletes really just want to focus on their own thing and try to work towards their goals. And I personally think it's better for everybody if everybody supports each other and tries to lift each other up rather than, you know, kind of being enemies and having a lot of friction in the relationships. But, you know, not every athlete feels the same way.
Right.
Justin, let me ask you a couple of direct questions. Kaylee Humphries alleged that head coach Todd Hayes was mentally and emotionally abusive. How would you define the training environment and culture of Canadian bobsled in relation to her allegations?
You know, that hasn't been my experience at all, like not even a little bit. I mean, you know, Todd is a firm coach and a strong leader, and I think that's what every team needs. And we haven't always had that in the past, so it is different to have that kind of strong, firm leadership. But it never crosses any lines, not that I've seen anyway. So, you know, I was pretty surprised when I heard about the allegations. Certainly hasn't been my experience at all, nor any of the athletes that I've talked to, which is pretty much the entire World Cup team.
Kaylee Humphries also said that there are bobsledders who are no longer competing anymore for Canada due to reasons that she stated in her allegations. Are you aware of any bobsledders who have left the team because of said allegations?
Not that I know of. I mean, certainly not directly. I mean, I can think of people who have had issues with decisions the program has made in the past. The majority of them are in their late 30s and early 40s, though. So I think that they left because, you know, they're at the age where you kind of retire from the sport. Any people younger than that, I mean, not that I know of. I'm sure it could be possible that, you know, people didn't have a good experience and left because of that. A lot of the times, though, in my experience, if the decisions don't go your way, you kind of have a negative experience. And, you know, sports doesn't always go your way. Mm-hmm. The Olympic competition is tough. Making the Olympic team's hard, and making the team that you want to be sliding on, like with the pilot you want to be sliding on, is really difficult as well. There's not very many spots up there. And, you know, a lot of times if athletes aren't chosen, they think that the coach has made the wrong choice.
It almost, you know, Justin, it almost seems to me in a lot of ways like it's F1 as well. It's F1 racing, Formula One racing, because you have a finite set of resources. And, you know, every team, I would imagine, figures out how to distribute those resources differently, whether it's equal across the board or, you know, the more competitive sled gets better equipment. I mean, whatever the thing, you know, whatever thought processes go into making that decision. And I'm wondering if it, quite frankly, and this may be an unfair question to you, but in some ways, do you think maybe it's, you know, Kaylee just wanted more than the Canadian program at this time could give her? And I mean that, I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean that in terms of resources, technology, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, as far as resources, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it is very much like Formula One. You have a set budget, and, you know, Formula One budgets are pretty big. Ours are pretty small. But the reality is the program doesn't have enough resources to support everybody at a high level, and it doesn't really even have the resources to support individual, not even one or two athletes at the highest level. Everybody I know in bobsleigh in Canada that's been successful has had to go outside the program to find sponsors that will support them with resources to buy better equipment. And part of that is because if it's not up to you what equipment you use, like if there's somebody ranked higher than you, or they decide that the Canada One men's pilot is actually number two to the Canada One women's pilot, then you might not have the best set of runners, and that can be a last minute thing. And that leaves you in a not competitive piece of equipment. So everybody I know that's won Olympic medals has gone outside the program to find resources to buy the equipment they need, Kaylee included, myself included. And that's just the reality of the sport. So I think you're right.
Justin, who are the candidates now to take Kaylee Humphrey's seat as we look towards the 2022 Olympics in Beijing?
We've got Christine De Bruin, who had a pretty good season last year. She's been driving for quite a while now. I think she's got to be between 6 and 8 years in the front seat, I think. And she got a world championship medal last year, so she's ready to have a breakout. So she's definitely up there. And then Alicia Risling, I think they've been driving about the same amount of time. She's got at least one World Cup medal, and, you know, she could be a contender for that as well. So we have pilots for sure. I mean, the program's not necessarily flush with talented athletes. There's a lot of retirements after 2018, and but, you know, there's definitely people. I mean, it's not to the level of Kaylee with her, you know, 15 years of driving experience, but there certainly are people that will be competitive.
Justin, you can answer this for both the females and males, but it would be interesting just to get a little bit of an education. Is there a peak age for a bobsleigh driver, or an age where, I guess, the physical and the mental and the educational all come together to form what would be like an Olympic champion caliber driver?
Yeah, it certainly seems to me like it's kind of right around 30 or your early 30s, even towards your mid 30s. You can, by that time, you know, you've been driving long enough to have the experience on all the different tracks and have the skills to adapt quickly to a new track. Like the Olympic tracks, for example, they're usually brand new and you only get about 40 runs on them before the race. So you have to be pretty good at figuring out driving lines and then executing them without a lot of practice. So yeah, I think it's kind of, you know, early 30s to mid 30s is the sweet spot. A lot of the female drivers leave and retire earlier than the men. to start families and stuff like that, though. So it's maybe a little bit younger for them, but I'm not really sure. I think it's about the same.
Hey, Justin, we appreciate you joining us today. Thanks for your insight.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Thank you, Justin.
Justin Cripps, Olympic gold medalist, bobsled driver, and as we mentioned, a person who's kind of emerged as a spokesperson for the Canadian program. And it is fascinating. Christine Rutherford did a terrific look on sportsnet.ca, the whole situation surrounding Kaylee Humphreys. And, I mean, look, I know Kaylee a little bit, having spent some time with her and a couple of Olympics and lead up to a couple of Olympics. It's awfully hard to find anybody who's come out of the woodwork to support her. And, you know, generally, there have been enough people pass through that program. There have been people who've sort of had lost their spot in that program or pulled out of the program, that if there was something really, 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 really wrong with the program, you would have heard it. Because, again, I can't stress enough, these people stayed the same hotel. I mean, they're in Altenburg in East Germany. They're in the same hotel. You go into the lobby of the hotel, and you'll have the American team flaked out on this couch, the Canadian team over here, and the Swiss team here, and somebody using somebody's laptop computer. There are very few secrets in that world, with the exception of some of the technological edges that, for example, the German team has. The German team is kind of like Ferrari. They're on their own. They stay with themselves. People always assume that they're doing something illegal with the runners and stuff like that. But it's, there aren't a lot of secrets. There are a lot of very close personal relationships there. And as we talked about, there's also a history of athletes competing from multiple countries at that point, as is the case with any internationals.
Yeah. German bobsleds, man, those technologies crazy. How do you think it will play in Canada if she ends up on the podium for the United States?
Well, see, this is interesting now because I don't know whether she is going to have her own sled or whether she is going to ride in the sled of Alana Myers, who is her best friend.
Right.
So I don't know if that's the case. Frankly, you and I could be in a sled with Alana Myers and we'd win a medal. She's the U.S. version of Kaylee Humphreys. So I don't know.
Like, I guess what I'm asking you is because it's bobsleigh and, again, amazing athletes, great sport, but we're not talking ice hockey. Do you think the Canadian public will be upset seeing a former Canadian athlete winning for the U.S.?
Absolutely they will. Oh, it'll piss them off completely.
Yeah,
it'll piss them off completely. And, but again, that's, it's not something, you know, it's something the program's had to deal with in the past. The difference is that Kaylee's been so successful.
Yeah, this is a high-profile infection.
And I'm trying to think of it right now. There was, I got a brain cramp. I mean, there was a fellow who is a regular member of the Canadian team who ended up going and competing in Monaco for a couple of years because he was paid money to go, and he was granted citizenship in Monaco. And that just happens. I mean, there are American drivers. Well, Chris Spring, a Canadian driver, I believe is Australian. Could be wrong. And he's driving for Canada. So it happens, right? Yeah. It's like the world. It's the same thing with soccer. It's a world of international sports.
We see this all the time.
We see this all the time.
Yep.
But the difference here is that she was such a dominant athlete. And she was, you know, she winning her gold medal in Calgary really catapulted her and Heather Moyse into sort of a different pantheon of Canadian female athletes.
Yeah, and you know, when you're talking about like going the podium, Jeff, and like the targets that the country sets, you know, especially for the Winter Olympics, it's a big loss because this is somebody who,
sure,
generally speaking, you know, is going to be on the medal stand somewhere.
Well, and you get your funding in Canada based on your ability to deliver medals.
Right.
And what this has done effectively, as I said, if she drives with Alana Myers, that's one thing. But if she decides to be a pilot on her own, that would have an exponential impact in that it will increase the number of sleds that the U.S. team may have to qualify. It increases her chances at winning a medal. And yeah, it's, I mean, it could have a profound economic impact on the Canadian program. Never mind that when you're out soliciting funds for your program from corporate donors, what better way to get your attention than to have somebody come in with an Olympic medal around their neck to talk to your board of directors or to go for lunch with your marketing people and talk about developing a relationship that is going to see your company or your business give money to the program.
Yeah, you know, to Justin's point now, if you're Canadian bobsleigh, you want some positive news. You want the focus to be on results. You want the focus to be on up-and-coming athletes. I don't know when the next major meet is, but, you know, if you're that organization, you really hope that the focus stops being this story and starts being on your hopefuls for the Beijing Games.
Yeah, and, you know, that will happen. There have been some younger sliders who've come into the program in the women's side, but you know, nobody who would enter a race as a prohibitive favorite to win not just a medal, but to win a gold medal or win a world championship.
Yeah, it's big. It's a story that's dominated sort of the talk of, you know, outside of obviously the world championships and DeGrasse type, et cetera, but it's been a big story for the Olympics.
Yeah, for amateur sports in Canada, it's a big story. And it's kind of a weird little story.
I don't know where the investigation stands, but
it's been done.
There's no resolution.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to know who ultimately where the veracity ends.
I'm not certain there's any veracity here. I think this may just be a case of relationship that had sort of run its course. I'm sure Kaylee's at the point where she's looking for another, maybe
those are big
one
charges,
or two
though,
more
you,
Olympics.
You know, mentally and emotionally abusive is a charge, though.
Yeah, but it's, again, if you're going to make that charge,
you got to back it up.
You got to back it up. Yeah. And you would think that somebody would, you'd think somebody with the current team would say something. And, it, you know, and it's also got to be said in the case of Todd Hayes. I mean, this is a guy who had some issues when he was with the U.S. program as well. He's a former coach of the U.S. program.
And I believe competitive bobsledder.
And
too,
right? Yes, yeah.
Medal winner. Yeah.
There are several avenues you can go with this. It could be rank opportunism. It could be, mixed messages. As I said, I tend to think it's a combination of a bunch of things, including a relationship that has run its course. But I think that sort of the nut of the thing is, you know, and you heard from Justin Cripps is, again, it's like F1. You've got limited resources. And boy, oh boy, people get their back up. If somebody comes along and says, you know what, we need to take some money from you and devote it to this other program because there's a young slider here who needs it. Yeah, I mean, there's any way you can go with this. I think we can all agree it's sad that one of the greatest Canadian amateur athletic careers has ended this way.
I will say, Jeff, this is a bit of a tangential point, but the 2022 Olympics in Beijing really sounds like a horrible Winter Games. It seems like a really odd choice for a Winter Olympics.
Covering the, I don't know. Nothing would surprise me. Maybe they'll build a winter village in the middle of Beijing. It wouldn't surprise me. I would never underestimate the ability of the Chinese to pull anything.
Oh yeah, no. The Olympics will run like we were both there. In
yeah,
Beijing.
I don't tend.
They'll run like clockwork. It just, I mean, you were there. That it. I mean, does anything speak to the winter in Beijing?
I haven't been there in the winter.
It's
more than Sochi. Sochi's a desert, for God's sake.
That's true. That's a beach.
Yeah. So, you know, this is newsflash. The Olympics has issues. Nobody wants to hold Olympic Games anymore.
Certainly not the winter.
No. Yeah. And the Winter Games were sort of the more easily manageable to do. Well, we'll have this conversation. I think at some point we're going to move towards permanent
Olympic
sites.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. For the winter, I think, for sure.
Yeah. And I think for summer as well, you're going to have 4 or 5 permanent sites and they'll just rotate. They'll just rotate through it. And I think in the Winter Olympics, one of those sites will definitely be in Canada. The Raptors are in Quebec City. They're preparing for the 2019-2020 season. We heard from them on Saturday at Media Day. Not much in the way of news, but interesting topics to discuss nonetheless. Eric Smith will join us from Quebec City. It's Primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. This is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Reminder that you could win tickets to a game or event in the Toronto area every weekday morning and qualify for our Leafs ticket giveaway every Friday on Leadoff with Ashley, Ziggy, and Scotty Mac. Listen weekday mornings or visit sportsnet.ca/590 for more details. 6:30 today, Amy Trask, NFL analyst with CBS Sports, will join us and take a look at the mess that was the NFL weekend. Great weekend for the Vikings, by the way. Maybe the best weekend in the last 2 years because Adam Thielen's come out and said that the head coach is an idiot and that the starting quarterback is awful. So he's basically saying all the things that are Arash Madani and myself have been saying.
What a
for
mess
the last
that franchise
years.
Is. Yeesh.
Yeah. It's good fun, though. It's almost enough to make me watch the Vikings again. The Raptors are in Quebec City. Strange place to hold training camp. I mean, I understand that you're moving the team around the country, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. Just seems like a strange place to hold.
Stastny's? Love Quebec City. What?
That the first thing you think of with Quebec City is Stastny's?
I think of the Nordiques. Yeah, of course. What should I be thinking of?
Eric Smith, our Raptors radio voice on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, joins us from Le Vieux, Ville, or whatever they call it. Le Vieux, Quebec. How you doing, Eric?
Bonjour. How are you?
I'm doing well.
That's about the extent of it.
I'm doing well. Listening to some of the stuff out of Raptors Media Day on Saturday, Eric, it was odd in that everything's going to be odd after the way the season ended and even what the dialogue was at the start of the year. But I have to say that my first takeaway from it was, and again, it's media day, and everybody, everybody's tied for first place and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I really did get the sense that this is still a pretty confident group, isn't it?
It is, and that was, I had a very similar takeaway, to be honest with you. Obviously they're not going to come out and say, yeah, we're screwed. Kawhi left for the Clippers and Danny Green's with the Lakers. But I still think that, to a man, they believe that they have a chance to still be very good. And I don't know that I disagree when there's no denying you're going to take a step back when you don't have one of the two, top two or three players in the game in your lineup any longer. But a full season with a veteran player like a Marc Gasol, another full season with the emerging and improving Pascal Siakam coming off most improved player honors. Another season with, the veteran leadership and the tenacity and the grit of a guy like a Kyle Lowry. And you hope, and I underscore hope, the continued progression of Fred VanVleet, Norm Powell, a major step up from an otherwise forgettable season last year, both personally and professionally for OG Anunoby. The list goes on. There's reasons to believe that this team can be very good. And I'll tell you the other thing, guys, when I look around the East, and I've said this a couple times, I'll be the first to admit if or when I'm wrong at the end of the season, Jimmy Butler leaving Philadelphia, going to Miami. Granted, Philly gets Al Horford, but they lose a lot of their scoring. Kyrie Irving going from the Celtics. Kemba Walker goes to Boston. Maybe that's addition by subtraction for the Celtics. Brooklyn gets a little bit better, maybe, even though D'Angelo Russell had a hell of a year and Kyrie Irving replacing D'Angelo Russell. They don't have Kevin Durant yet with the Nets. I look at all these teams, Milwaukee losing former Rookie of the Year and Malcolm Brogdon, but yeah, okay, they still have Giannis. And yeah, I kind of look at it around and I say, all right, was it sort of a shuffling of deck chairs for some of these teams? And is Toronto really that much worse than a lot of these squads? At the very least, we're talking about the Raptors as a number two seed last year. I don't see them dropping off drastically and becoming a 7-8 seed, a team barely making the playoffs. I still think they're a top 4 or 5 team in the conference. And if you get top 4, you get home court advantage in that first round. To me, all bets are off. Get into round 2, and you could very well see this team in the conference championship again and trying to go for a second straight appearance in the final. So, I mean, that's all very, painting a very positive picture, but I see no reason why the picture shouldn't be positive right now and why this team shouldn't think that they're pretty good.
Yeah, and hearing you talk about that, I wish I could remember which national commentator it was. It was one of the national commentators in the States, and they were breaking down sort of the offseason moves in the NBA, and they said, look, if you're the Raptors, given all the movement that went on in the league this year, you could have come out a lot worse. Like, it's going to seem odd to people saying, well, Kawhi Leonard's gone and Danny Green's gone. But who in the East blew your doors off to the point where they're going to be way better than they were last year? Like,
nobody.
You know, nobody, as long as if Kevin Durant doesn't play, nobody, I think, has improved to that point where you'd go, my God, they're going to run away with it.
No, exactly. He's the only one. And that's not to knock anybody else. There were good players that came to or stayed in or moved around the Eastern Conference, but not to the extent that you saw, obviously, in the Western Conference with Anthony Davis staying in the West, albeit, but moving on to the Lakers, and Kawhi Leonard going to the Clippers, along with Paul George, and the Russell Westbrook trade to the Houston Rockets, and even D'Angelo Russell joining Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Draymond Green. Thompson, of course, went healthy in Golden State, and Chris Paul and a part of that move ending up with the Oklahoma City Thunder. All of the major moves, all of the major players and the movers and shakers were in the Western Conference. I went over some of the teams in the East with Boston losing Kyrie but adding Kemba and Jimmy Butler, going from Philly to Miami. Teams have gotten better. Teams are good, but not great per se. So if you're Toronto, absolutely the best of the worst case scenario is Kawhi Leonard goes, yet you still look at it and say, why can't we be the second seed again? This is not meant as a knock, Jeff, Richard, not meant as a knock at all. But if you could 2-3 years ago, let alone 4 or 5 years ago, if you could win 50, 52, 55, almost 60 games with a team in Toronto that was solidified by a 1-2 punch of DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, I see no reason to think why you can't win 50, 52, 55 games with a team that's solidified by Kyle Lowry and Pascal Siakam, with a Marc Gasol, let alone with some of those other younger pieces that I think are better pieces than what you had in those previous carnations of this Raptors team a few years back. I think the core of this team overall, or maybe even the depth of this team might be a better way to say it, is better than the depth of those teams that I'm speaking to a few years back that, won the first round, bounced out in the first round, won in the second round, advanced to the conference finals against the Cavs, et cetera. I think this team is as good on paper, at least, as good, if not better, than some of those squads that were trying to be led to the next level by DeRozan and Lowry. I think they can do it. I think they've got the opportunity to still be a very good team. It's, to me, the bigger question, what happens at the end of the season? Because assuming it all goes well, I mean, if it goes sideways, I think we all know trades will be made, contracts won't be signed, et cetera. But if it does go well and you are a second, third, fourth seed, you do win a round or two or more in the playoffs, you do have a 50-plus win season. What do you do with Kyle Lowry? What do you do with Marc Gasol? What do you do with Serge Ibaka, all free agents? What do you do with Fred VanVleet, free agent? There are a lot of interesting conversations and questions for the Raptors, both pro and con, that will develop over the course of the next, 6, 8, 10 months.
Yeah, and I think some of those questions actually will even be more apparent prior to the end of the season, Eric, because Masai Ujiri, Bobby Webster will have a decision to make depending on how well these guys do. Do they try to make an addition to really try to go for the conference final again? Or obviously, if things are not going well, do you think about dealing one of the big contracts? What I want to ask you about, and I don't know how much this was talked about at media day, but without Kawhi Leonard and without Danny Green, there's significant minutes and, maybe more importantly, significant shot attempts that will exist for a couple of players. And I wonder whether it's Norm Powell or Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or whomever. Did Nick Nurse talk at all about who he thinks may be first in line to get those minutes and to get those shots?
It was talked a little bit about on media day, Richard, but we actually went into it in greater detail today. So it's a timely question, no doubt. First and foremost is Pascal Siakam. He's going to gobble up a lot of the attention and the touches. And he spoke today about needing to be ready for the workload. And he says he is ready, and he knows that he's going to have to be prepared to, you know, be a better passer when he sees those double and triple teams. He's going to have to be a more diverse player in terms of being able to shoot and finish around the rim and be in the mid range and, you know, do all sorts of different things for this team on the floor. He can't just be a one dimensional player. And the good thing for him, I guess, Richard, is he started to see more of that attention in the postseason when he was drawing the assignment of the, you know, the opposing team's best defender on a lot of nights and in a lot of those games, you know, no matter which round we talk about. You know, he very quickly moved up the scouting report for a lot of opposing teams. But the other thing is, Nick Nurse said today, is it might not necessarily have to be Pascal every single night being the go-to guy. He said it might be by committee, and he's very much looking at his lineup and his roster being by committee as well. He said, you know, people forget we're not only missing the offense of Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard, that's two starters that we're missing. So the starting lineup is very much up for grabs, at least in two spots, and Nick Nurse saying it could be something that's fluid. It could be something where game to game, matchup to matchup, opponent to opponent, it could be a very different and fluid starting lineup for the Raptors. And thus it could be one night, Norm Powell, you need to lean on Norm to be more of a scorer and a guy that carries some of that offensive load. It might be a Fred VanVleet. And Nick Nurse even threw out the name Patrick McCaw, who he's looking for bigger things from, and for McCaw to take a bigger step in his young career. So I think when you start spreading the wealth out, spreading those shots out, the shots that are going to be created in the absence of Leonard and Green, it's going to be by a lot of those guys, let alone, obviously, Marc Gasol, Kyle Lowry, kind of carrying a chunk of that load as well. So I think it's really going to be a more balanced effort overall, and not just giving the ball, not that it was always like this, but giving the ball to one guy and letting him create. I think there are going to be multiple people that get opportunities at various points in the season.
Eric, I've said this a couple times in the air. I'm fascinated by this team and the many, many different questions this year, because the season could go so many different ways. Maybe you could say that about last year, but at a certain point, I think people knew this was a really good team, and they had a pretty high ceiling. This year, many, many questions. One of those, Eric, is Marc Gasol, in terms of how do you negotiate his minutes? He's coming off the FIBA World Championships where his team won. He played a lot of minutes in the playoffs, and he's not a young guy. He's 34, turning 35. How do you think, especially early in the season, they'll navigate that? And could Marc Gasol get a little bit of what Kawhi did in terms of maybe some load management games off?
Well, we already heard load management, those exact words mentioned yesterday, and it was somewhat tongue-in-cheek in regards to Marc Gasol. But the reality is that is the way it's going to go, I think, Richard, especially early part of the season. Nick Nurse, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, guys, he said both Marc Gasol and Kyle Lowry will be managed early in the season and certainly through training camp. Both of them have not taken part fully in the first 2 days of camp. They've done none of the contact drills, only really done some shooting on the side and some light shooting after camp ended today. Gasol was on the floor for an extra 30, 45 minutes or so. But Lowry has spent most of the first 2 days stretching and being, you know, worked on by the trainers on the sideline as he still recovers from the thumb injury. And Nurse said yesterday, again, in not so many words, understanding the grind of the 82-game season and the ultimate end goal being making sure your big man and your veteran players are healthy for May and June, not necessarily for October and November. There will be rest nights. There will be off nights. There will be limited minutes. I don't know what the number will be, but there'll be nights where he's playing 20, not 30 or 34, 35 minutes. There will be nights where he's, you know, giving the evening off. And I fully expect that to be very similar to what we saw with Kawhi last year. And again, I say, I think it'll be not just for Gasol, but it'll be for Lowry as well.
Eric, what do the Raptors do, or more precisely, how do they approach negotiations with Kyle Lowry? You know, there's talk of a legacy contract for Kyle Lowry, whatever that is. But has the equation changed as a result of the NBA championship?
I think it has. For me personally, for what that's worth, it has. If I was running the show, I think it has. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a little bit for Masai Ujiri as well. I mean, Masai was the one that uttered those words the other day that you just said, Jeff. And I mean, he wasn't necessarily prompted. He was simply just asked a similar question. And, you know, where do things stand with Kyle? And has the championship changed things? And considering the evolution of him as a person and as a player within, you know, his time in Toronto within the Raptors history books. And Masai was the one that first said, you know, there is a legacy, and his legacy has certainly vaulted up the charts in terms of his impact. I tell you, maybe I'm kind of giving away the lead here, guys, and I'm saying that to two writers, but the .ca folks at Sportsnet asked myself and Grange and Brad Fay and Jonesy and a bunch of others to put together our list of the top 25 Raptors in franchise history based on impact on basketball in the city and country, but also based on their careers. Mm-hmm. So kind of trying to factor in a couple of different things. I can tell you flat out, I don't know about Grange and Fay, but both Jonesy and I have Kawhi Leonard number two, DeMar DeRozan number three, with Kyle Lowry being number one in Raptors franchise history.
Yeah.
Oh, and I think winning that championship did that. And now if you're considered potentially by many people as the number one guy, the most important piece in Raptors franchise history, you owe it to that guy to try and keep him around and let him retire as a Raptor if he wants to. And if that comes at a cost, that might be the cost of doing business and taking care of one of your cornerstone guys and arguably your most important guy ever.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think it just seems right and proper for Kyle Lowry to end his career with the Raptors and whatever. And you know what? You've won a title. I got to think, Eric, that's one contract. Like God help the person who 3 years down the road looks at Masai Ujiri and says, I can't believe you gave Kyle Lowry that final contract. You know, I don't think there's any concern about that. I think if any athlete in the city warrants that type of contract, it's Kyle Lowry. It really is.
I agree. And listen, I acknowledge that I might be somewhat naive in saying this. I hope there is some sort of an appreciation from Lowry's side and his camp as well, to know that, listen, you're making, what, upwards of $25, $30 million right now. The next contract may or may not be that high.
Yep.
But it's not going to necessarily be for the same term, the same length.
Right.
You've got to have, I think, an honest appreciation and an honest awareness of who you are and what you are and how old you are, while also acknowledging you're still going to be very rich and still be taken care of and still be considered part of the history, the cornerstone, et cetera, if you're making 20 and not 29. I mean, if you want to get the money somewhere else and you have the chance to make more money somewhere else and you still have a chance to win a championship somewhere else and you decide to move on, fine. But I guess in maybe too many words, I'm kind of saying, I hope there is a little bit of a hometown discount or at mm-hmm. least an understanding, a gentleman's understanding that you know where you are at this place in your career. Because when this contract's up and you're in your, you know, early to mid 30s, and it's probably going to be your last deal, understand what you are and what kind of player you are, and that you can still be very good and still make a lot of money without handcuffing the team that you're hoping to end your career with.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you guys. I just, unfortunately, the history of the league, whether it's Patrick Ewing, Hakeem Olajuwon, great players yeah. who played with teams for a long time, a lot of times that last year or those last 2 years, they end up in a different uniform. It's very weird, but that's the case. Eric, the one thing I want to ask you about on the defensive end, and this is no genius observation by me, but as great as Kawhi Leonard was offensively, and he is ridiculous as an offensive player, I think, Eric, one of the things that is impossible to duplicate for this year's team is Kawhi's defensive impact. One, he locks down, generally speaking, the opposing team's best player. Two, he can guard multiple positions, so it doesn't have to just be a wing player or a shooting guard. We've seen Kawhi guard like Giannis types. And then lastly, he gets in the lane and deflects things. Obviously, we know his hands are like gigantic, so he can pull down rebounds. Mm-hmm. I guess, and again, I would just like your insight, is the only possible way to attack this issue with just different kinds of players coming in, defensive-oriented, like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson types, and you do the best you can because there essentially is no duplicating Kawhi on defense?
That's probably the easiest answer I could give you, Richard. Yeah, there is no duplicating. Kawhi Leonard. I don't think there is even his now, you know, his newest teammate, Paul George, as good as Paul George is defensively, he's not Kawhi Leonard, in my opinion. So I don't think there is any chance to duplicate what he did and what he meant to this team defensively. The one thing I guess I might point to is almost similar to where I started when I spoke about how good this team was X number of years ago, under a core of or a 1-2 punch of DeRozan and Lowry. This was still a team that not that long ago, without Kawhi Leonard, was the number one defensive team in the NBA. Now, granted, different personnel now, different head coach now, but I still think that the mentality or the philosophy that this team will preach more often than not, Richard, going into the season is defense first. I think they feel that they have enough scoring punch that they'll be able to score on most nights, and they'll be able to make up for the scoring loss of a Kawhi Leonard. But they know that they're going to have to be locked in defensively to make up for that absence. And you mentioned Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Stanley Johnson. I'll say again, OG Anunoby after a forgotten year, a guy that many people compare to a young Kawhi Leonard in terms of his defensive acumen. Norm Powell, wasn't that long ago that he was considered the best defender on this team and the guy that you would break the glass for in the postseason to say, you go guard LeBron James, you go guard Giannis Antetokounmpo, you go try and stop somebody. And he was the guy that the Raptors would lean on. You still have him. So there's four guys right there, let alone, you know, the tenacity that you get from a Fred VanVleet or a Kyle Lowry, a former Defensive Player of the Year, and Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka with his shot-blocking skills and his defensive prowess as well. I still think there are a lot of good defenders on this team that should help Toronto have that mentality and mantra of being that defensive-minded squad every single night, knowing, all right, we might have lost our best defender and a pretty solid defender too in Danny Green, but knowing we can still be very good defensively with those 6, 7, 8 guys I just rhymed off a moment ago as well.
Eric, we appreciate you doing this. Enjoy Quebec City. I never have to tell anybody that because you have to have something wrong with you fundamentally as a human being if you don't enjoy Quebec City, and I know you too well to know that you don't. So have a great time.
Well, I've spent most of the conversation walking along the waterfront in Quebec and down the cobblestone streets and obviously the very European feel that it is here. It's been about 25 years since I've been in the city. So,
oh, man.
It's great to be back, and I'm heading out for a few adult beverages right now and going to find a nice little spot to eat at and enjoy the next few days here, guys. Yeah. So I appreciate it.
I appreciate you doing Eric. Thanks so much. That is the best city in Canada.
Yeah, I got to go.
Nothing.
I cannot wait to see it one day.
Amy Trask is our NFL analyst. She's with CBS Sports. The NFL kicked a player out for the rest of the year, not for PEDs, but for a hit. Well done to the NFL. Amy Trask joins us. It's primetime on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now back to Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, well, stop me if you've heard this before. Vontaze Burfict has been suspended. In 7 years... before he joined the Raiders. 7 years of the Bengals, he was suspended or fined 13 times. That's pretty consistent in that regard. This time, though, it's different. He has been suspended for the remainder of the season, suspended without pay for the remainder of the season and the postseason for his helmet-to-helmet hit on Jack Doyle. We'll be joined by Amy Trask in a few minutes, and we can talk about her beloved Raiders. Oh, Amy Trask is now with us. So we can talk to Amy Trask about her beloved Raiders. And Amy, I'm sure no one saw this coming, right? Vontaze Burfict, that he would be suspended.
You know, it's disappointing. And I'm not talking about the suspension. I'm talking about the on-field action, which led to the suspension.
Right.
I believe, you know, I'm a firm believer in second chances and third chances. And I was someone who was given multiple chances, but at some point when you're given multiple chances, you need to take responsibility for your actions and make sure that you make the most of those chances. So when I say that I'm disappointed, I'm not expressing disappointment in the discipline as much as everything that has occurred and the fact that it's come to this.
Why? Okay, it's the longest suspension, I believe, in NFL history. And again, an entire regular season and postseason. I mean, this is clearly the league dropping the hammer in this guy. But why did it take? Why was this not done after his? I don't know, his 12th suspension or fine. Why did it take sort of this time to get it done?
Well, I certainly can't answer that. And as you men know, my she went to law school background is such, or maybe it's just the person that I am is such, that I don't speculate as to the mm-hmm. reasoning of others. If you want, why don't we conference call the league office in right now and we can just get them on the line and say, what up?
Right.
But all teasing aside, I don't know. I mean, clearly, and by the way, one doesn't know if the suspension is going to hold up for the
True.
Entire time. The league made a loud, clear statement by imposing a substantial suspension, but there may be an appeal and one doesn't know what the, I was going to say appellate justice, but the appeals officer will say.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let me say, this is Amy Trask with a little bit of an edge. So I like this Amy Trask today. This is not the, in different times on this show, we've seen the UN Amy Trask, the diplomat Amy Trask. But today, I feel some edge in your voice, and I like this Amy Trask. This is the kind of person I feel like was on the shoulder of Al Davis, sort of, whispering in Al's ear saying, let's do this. This is the CEO Trask. Yeah. I like this.
I do try to moderate my behavior and my language when I'm on air. Because, and I apologize, I don't know what the Canadian equivalent of the FCC is, but I am very, very careful when I join radio or television shows to watch my mouth because I don't want anyone getting in trouble with regulatory bodies.
You can say stuff in this show and in Canada that you can't say in the U.S.
Correct.
Consider this like satellite radio without the satellite.
Good to know, man. Good to know.
All right, Amy, I will now, it's good. I will now ask you a football question.
I'm kidding.
No, she can, she can. Oh. Amy, you can, trust me on this.
Yeah.
You can definitely push the envelope further on Canadian radio than you can.
Just no hyphenated words.
That's probably true. Yeah, avoid the hyphenated words.
There was a discussion, an argument I was having with Al. Richard just mentioned me being in his ear, him being in my ear. We had a very, very protracted, angry argument, and there was a hyphenated word he wanted me to use in a context I didn't think was to our advantage to use it. And I ended the discussion by saying, all right, is that one word or two? And I won't mention the word, but I have a big smile on my face as I recall that.
Very good.
All right. Now I want to know the word. I can guess. All right, Amy, let's talk football, all right? The Texans, the Colts, the Jaguars, the Titans, they're all 2-2. They all kind of look like mediocre football teams. Any of these teams, in your opinion, can break out and maybe sort of get away from the rest?
Well, I'm going to, kids would call this a humble brag. I think humble and brag, it's an oxymoron, so I'm just going to call it a brag. Before the season, I said of that division, the AFC South, look, that division's wide open. It's up for grabs. And that was before Luck retired. And that was before we saw an injury to Foles. I think that division is wide open. Someone's going to win it. By definition, someone is going to win it. But right now, I think it's anyone's division.
Let me one of the signature news items over the last couple of days, or maybe the last week, I should say, to be more accurate, is the NFL owners wanting a, or sort of now conceding to try to aim for a 17-game schedule as opposed to an 18-game schedule. Obviously, the NFLPA will have to have its opinion on this, but what kind of success do you give the prospect of the league eventually going to 17 games?
I give it, I don't know how to handicap it for you. I don't know a percentage to assign it to it, but I do think it is, there's a good chance we will see that at some point for a number of reasons. And I like it with one big but, and I will give you the but in a minute. What I like about it is you could take that 17th game, that one extra oddball game, because instead of 8-8, both of which are even numbers at 16, you've now got an odd game. Rather than making it home or away, put it in a neutral site, whether that's an international neutral site or a site that is, you know, simply not one in which a team is based. Move that game around and grow the game nationally, internationally, both by having a neutral site game that's neither home nor away. My caveat is this, and I would say this even if the game, if it stays at 16 games, so no matter what, expand the roster. Health and safety concerns dictate it, and league economics support it. There is no magic to the number 53. I would expand the roster, and I would do so substantially, not by a player or two. So were I negotiating on behalf of the players, that would be something very important to me. And I'll tell you, men, if I may go on for another moment, stop me if I can't, that during my career, when I discussed expansion, or my career in the league, not my current career, when I discussed expanding the roster with players, many, many veterans didn't like that idea. And when I probed that, I learned that it's because they thought X amount of dollars, greater number of players means on average less per player. But when I then asked veterans, would they feel differently if they believed they were at a point in their career where they might not make the 53-man roster, their views changed because, of course, they'd like the ability to stay on the team longer.
Hey, Amy, just returning the focus to the field for a bit, the Dallas Cowboys losing to New Orleans yesterday. You know, look, a lot of talk from the start of the year on, really, about how Kellen Moore and Dak Prescott, how there was this, it's not that they were going to reimagine offense, but a lot of talk about their creativity, et cetera, et cetera. The game against New Orleans, I think Ezekiel Elliott averaged under 2 yards per carry. There were 7 sacks. If you are Dallas, was this just you ran up against a really good defense? Or do you look at your offensive line and go, you know, hey, it's great to have all these neat gizmos and running backs and quarterback and receiver, but if our offensive line isn't better, we're going to end up wasting a lot of opportunities. How would they view that loss? As something hinting at something systemically wrong with them, or just, you know, damn, New Orleans is a pretty good defense?
Well, twofold. One, New Orleans is a very good defense. And number two, you played them on the road in New Orleans. And I think you evaluate it differently if the loss is at home than if it's on the road. Men, New Orleans is a tough venue for a visiting team. It is cacophonous in there. The passion is tremendous. And not to name names, but it rhymes with Shmamey. That person yesterday on that other pregame show on CBS Sports Network said New Orleans was going to win the game. So if you can think of someone named whose name rhymes with Shmamey, she said that on the show yesterday. I really do believe we might have seen a different outcome were the game in Dallas. So I wouldn't kind of wig out if I were the Cowboys. There are things they need to address because certainly they're going to continue to play good teams as the season, you know, if they go into the postseason, and they may be playing them on the road. So a good team played a good team. And, you know, early in my career in the league, someone said something I considered very wise, which is it shouldn't always be an analysis of one team loss rather than a really good team won.
You just name-checked yourself with a rhyme. You realize that?
I it was kind of cool, huh?
That's pretty good.
Let me channel my inner Baker Mayfield or my outer Baker. I'm feeling a little woke up, feeling a little dangerous.
All right. Well, listen. That's always first of all. Let's talk about the Browns. One, I cannot love Baker Mayfield more because he calls out the media knuckleheads like Rex Ryan and Colin Coward when they say ridiculously dumb things. So that's one. I love the guy for that, the swag. Two, I love the Browns. I don't know what it is about them. I don't know if it's just all the great skill position players, Jarvis Landry, Odell Beckham, Nick Chubb, but I think they're a fascinating team. And Amy, this week, they rolled the Ravens, which was everybody's darling. Can we now say that, I'm not saying the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl, but can we now say that this is a legit team with a legit, legit playoff chance?
Well, that's another division that I believe, and going into the season, believed was up for grabs, and the Browns just demonstrated to us yesterday that it is. I would not have been as surprised by that game were it in Cleveland, but you are absolutely right. To go do on the road to a Baltimore team that we have been seeing play tremendous football all season, well, three games, which is so far all season, on the road. That was just a huge, dominating win for Cleveland. And, you know, to put it in sort of street talk or kid talk, they didn't just talk the talk, which Baker does. They walked the walk.
Amy, Adam Thielen had some pointed words for Kirk Cousins. God bless him. I love Adam Thielen. But some pointed words for Kirk Cousins and for the Vikings staff after their loss. It's four games into the season. Is this a big deal or just kind of, you know, one of those things that happens over the course of a season? Because it's pretty obvious that, yeah, there's a thinking, I think, a lot of Vikings people that, you know, if you make sure Kirk doesn't pass the ball, you have a chance to win. On the other hand, Dalvin may end up getting hurt if you keep handing the ball to him 50 times a game.
Well, raise your hand if you were perplexed by the Cousins signing by the Vikings when they made the signing.
Yeah, there's lots of people
up?
Raising
my
their hands.
Up.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, because my hand was up or is up. You know, I don't – players say things in the heat of passion after a game. So, you know, the answer to your question may be yes and yes. Maybe, yes, it was one of those things that said after the game. And I do believe I heard something to the effect that he's tried to walk those comments back a little bit or soften them a little bit. But it's yes and yes. Yes, it's passionate comments after a game about which one is passionate. But, yes, there also may be an issue in Minnesota that needs to be sorted out with respect to the issues he raised. I guess what I'm saying is it's not mutually exclusive.
You want one more for us, or you feel like you've given us all your insight today?
Give it to me. Come on. I'm ready.
All right. Listen, now that you have become a major player at CBS Sports, do you feel like Tony Romo, who would have been given the week off had he qualified for this golf tournament, are you at that place where you can call your CBS bosses and be like, you know what, I got something this week really important to me. You're going to have to get somebody else to analyze football.
Okay. First of all, I hope that all of your listeners understand that when he says I'm a big deal there, he's saying it with a giant smile on his face because he knows that's not the case, just as I do. And, you know, the honest question to that is I think if I picked up the phone and did that, I might get new phone. Who dis?
You've dropped so much street language today, Amy. I'm impressed by you.
And it's been clean, which is good.
Well, thank you. I'm really working at that. And by the way, I will say this, and I do it in all sincerity, not to be politically correct. You know what? CBS is very, very, very accommodating of many, many requests from many, many people. I live 3,200 miles from CBS Sports Network, and they are always very willing to assist me with logistics associated with that long flight back and forth across the country.
Yeah, they're honestly a very good place to work for. Business class for you or first, usually, when we make that trip?
Telling that on air.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either.
That's the answer's first.
I wouldn't either. Ms. Trask, we're going to let you run. As always, we appreciate your time and your insight. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy Trask.
Love her.
She's got to fly first class.
CBS is network, Jeff, so I think first class would be my guess.
CBS does have a reputation for treating its folks pretty
well.
They
do. Interestingly enough, Fox and NBC do as well. Not to say ESPN doesn't, but the ESPN, which you sort of think is the, you know, the pinnacle of sports, they're a little cheaper with their talent than the networks.
Yeah, but they got that big thing every year where they drag everybody down to Disneyland. Isn't
yeah,
it?
And
they
plus,
still do
and
that.
And they have the ESPYs too. You can get the boondoggle to Los Angeles. But ESPN's philosophy, I think Canadian sports fans would be interested in, is that ESPN's management always thinks ESPN is the star.
Yeah.
Where at the networks, they think like Tony Romo's the star.
Yeah.
And it's a different philosophy in terms of management.
I think ESPN has always been kind of you're lucky to work for us, whereas other networks are, we're lucky to have you
working
for
ESPN
us.
Looks at it as, you know, it's sort of a little bit of a hubris, like you're here, we'll pay you what we're going to pay you, where the other places, you're right, it's talent, they look at talent differently.
Clearly, neither of us are wired in enough to make this comment. But Amy made an interesting point about Vontaze Burfict and about how the appeal has been launched.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are of the NBA or the NFL acquiescing here and walking it back to maybe an 8 or 10 game suspension.
Generally speaking,
that's what happens generally. Always. Is it not?
Yeah, the NFL
it always happens.
Yeah, the NFLPA, and even though it's frustrating, I think, for fans to be like, listen, this guy's guilty, but the NFLPA is always arguing for sort of the body as a
whole. That's their job. Yeah, that's their job. Their job is to appeal.
I think what usually happens is the adjudication gets reduced a little bit. The only caveat, Jeff, I say here is that because he's such a repeat offender,
his 14th suspension or fine.
He may be done for the year. But as a general rule, if you bet on these suspensions and punishments being reduced on appeal, they almost always are. I mean, you look like Kareem Hunt. And so everybody comes back in the league, except for Colin Kaepernick, of course. But that's the one sort of like little caveat I'd say is he has so many infractions. He's essentially considered the dirtiest player in the league. He may go.
We didn't have a chance to talk to Amy about this, but the Bills lost to the Patriots.
They played. That was tighter than I thought.
And just again, you know, we talk about the Bills defense. That was a perplexed looking Tom Brady at times. I mean, clearly definitely. The Bills have figured, I'm going to say they figured something out, but clearly they did something yesterday that either caught Tom Brady unawares. But I wanted to ask you about the hit on Josh Allen, because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of commentary after the game. Now, there's no doubt it was a personal foul, and it was assessed as such. Did you think it warranted an ejection?
I did. I thought it was you hit a defenseless guy. The argument, of course, is that he was a runner and he put his head down. I think, to me, we talked about this before the show, and I thought your take was good. I think if it was Brady, unquestionably be gone, but you were arguing with me that like there are different rules for stars, and you're correct. There are. That's the reality of life. I think if you are committed to protecting quarterbacks above and beyond, how could you not run that guy out after that hit?
And that was a weird thing, too. I mean, Josh Allen running off the field and, you know, and sort of waving his arms as he's running off. It's sort of, you know, I'll be back. I'm just going into.
By the way, I'm not, it's impossible to know. They may have won that game had Josh Allen stuck around. I mean, you know, they're only down a touchdown, and Matt Barkley came in, and that's a lot to ask against a pretty good defense to try to win.
Yeah, no, listen, if you're a Bills fan, again, I really believe that the Bills defense is the thing that if they're going to go on a run, if they're going to have some success, basically you want Josh Allen not making big mistakes, and you want your defense to win games for you. And everything I've seen from that defense early, and granted it has not been the toughest schedule around, but everything I've seen from that defense early, that looks to me like an upper tier defense.
And the one thing to think about with the Bills is there's 4 wins, I think, between the Jets and Dolphins.
Sure, absolutely.
They're better than those teams. Obviously, the Pats are tough, and it's, again, on the road. So the wild card is there for them. I have to look at the, sort of the rest of the schedule, but I think they're definitely a top-10 defense. And, you know, Frank Gore could stay healthy for the year, and Josh Allen could stay healthy. They have a shot. The last thing with Josh Allen, Jeff, real quick, is that, listen, you admire the guy as an athlete and a runner, but at a certain point, someone's going to have to teach or tell that guy he's going to lose it. I mean, he's going to get out for a season one day if he runs that aggressively. He has to protect himself.
Yeah, I don't know if this team is good enough offensively for him to do that and be successful.
You may be right, cuz that's kind of like a big part of their offense is his ability to scramble out of pocket, right, and make yards.
I mean, you're right. Ideally, you would want him to practice a little more self-preservation, but I don't know, again, if this team has enough at the receiving position. I certainly don't think they have enough at the running back position where he can't, you know, where he has to be.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. More
aggressive.
Control. I mean, he's going to have to be more aggressive for them to have success.
One of their strengths on offense, obviously, is when a play breaks down, just his ability to run. So you're right about that.
But again, if you're a Bills fan, you know, the game was there. And certainly you can have a conversation about would the outcome have been different with Josh Allen. It's certainly a valid conversation to have.
Definitely.
If you're a Bills fan. That is it for us. We've got playoff baseball starting tomorrow.
And then the Leafs.
And then the Leafs on Wednesday. We'll have a lot to talk about tomorrow. Good night from Toronto.